This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 131, brought to you in association with Smart Pension. And we're joined today by Mike Bristow, founder and CEO of Crowd Property, who are a P2P offering development finance loans, to discuss disintermediating the property project value chain. As we sit here in central London, I'm very glad to say for you all, as well as for me and Mike, that a very noisy drilling outside has just ceased. There is a huge property project going on behind us, and property projects are one of these worlds, like many of the others that we've discussed, which are very much a world unto themselves. If you haven't been in it, you can have very little feel for what it's like. So let's find out about that world today and how fintech and P2P and all that kind of stuff is making it smoother and more 21st century. Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi, Mike. Thank you for joining me today.
Hi, Mike. Pleasure to be here.
So we were talking about Euston Station, actually, in London, talking of property. And as we will come on to a little bit later, Crowd Property are actually based in Birmingham, which is far away in the regions where I started many years ago. And Euston Station isn't the best example of a station. And for those people abroad, over here, one of the controversies, which sadly both the contenders for next Prime Minister seem to think is a good idea, is this thing called HS2, where we're going to spend 60, 80, 100 billion pounds on making trains go a little bit faster to places like Birmingham.
Indeed, Euston's not exactly an architectural triumph. Actually, whereas just down the road St Pancras is, I'm a firm believer it's a shame that that doesn't serve Birmingham, given how much I'm in and out there. But you're right. A few years ago, I worked on the economic case for the Thames Estuary Airport, which I thought was the right answer, but we don't necessarily have structurally the right long-term view to be able to say, right, let's do something that radical and instead, right, let's replace some train tracks.
Yes, I've been thinking about this quite a lot because boring listeners once again about this darn book. I've got rather bogged down the 19th century. Why limited liability companies arose? And the answer is that if I ask you now, or ask anybody, you'll go blah, blah, blah the way that I would have a year ago. But it's actually a great mystery, strangely, right, as I'm writing about. So looking quite a lot at the 19th century, one of the things then was that politicians were prepared to do bold things. So, for example, Parliament said, for the first time in history, anywhere on the planet, we can have completely limited liability companies for everybody. Europe had some version, commender, of passive investors having limited liability, but the management having unlimited liability. So that suddenly gets introduced. And of course, huge crises, huge company collapses, as you imagine, which have continued to this day as a result of that decision. Whereas you get to now, and politicians seem to spend most of their time virtue signalling and delegate responsibility. A simple example being, I saw something on Twitter recently about, you know, the BBC's bias, we want the government to debate this in Parliament, so I just signed up the petition. You know, got the usual patronising reply, which is, look, Sonny, we know how to run this country, piss off and mind your own business, wrapped up in civil services or something. Anyway, I think more people must have signed it, so it actually is now going to be debated in Parliament. But the first version of the reply was that, oh, this isn't a matter for the government, this is the matter for Ofcom. And when Sir Paul Tucker was on the show, one of the points that he made, which has stuck with me ever since, because I hadn't particularly spotted it, which is, whilst there is the case of the greedy bureaucrat in all of these regulators trying to expand their empire, get more budget, more people, more importance, and more interference, the other part of that chain is that politicians around the world, and in the United States as well, are only too keen to wash their hands of any big decisions. So, oh yes, BBC bias, oh, that's nothing to do with us, that's Ofcom. So, oh yes, Thames Link Estuary, oh, we'll have a review on that. So you end up with politicians who are just virtue signalling, you know, the modern version of kissing babies, and not actually making decisions. You know, you haven't had a conviction politician in this country since Thatcher, for better and for worse. They're just management.
A few years ago, I think it was 2013, 2014, the year that we kicked the third runway Heathrow debate further into the long grass, I think that year China built 52 runways. So, you know, we are slipping.
And we take, going back to project finance and all this kind of stuff, which is the broader context of property projects, we are taking longer and longer and longer to make fewer and fewer decisions. And so I think it's this more than anything else, which is meaning that we will continue, we and Europe as a whole, which has got massively bureaucratic, continue declining in the 21st century because other countries don't. China's a very good example. Hong Kong, which is half China, but very controversial at the moment, given all the difficulties over there with the extradition law. They just decided to build another one way on an island somewhere, so they created an island out of nothing, built it, while the sort of Heathrow review was, you know, barristers were still charging 10 grand a day and racking it up.
And that gives them access to a hell of a lot of GDP. That economic flow is so valuable.
Yeah, critically important that we continue our infrastructure but have a global perspective on it.
Yes, I'm pessimistic because I can't see how it changes.
It's hard to be optimistic on this topic.
Yes. Well, as my kids are sort of warned, now left university, and they will leave university next year. I just keep telling them to emigrate somewhere more sensible. Anyway, so that's project finance. And as a whole, this country is getting more and more pathetic and wimpy about it. So let's turn to the property projects, development property. How did you get here from when you were a lad? What led you? What was your journey?
Back to your early days as well. I went to University of Birmingham, did a very quant-heavy degree, Master's in Mechanical Engineering. Went into management consultancy, Strat Consultancy specifically. Did a lot of advisory private equity, both on M&A and corporate strategy. That was around 17 or 18 years worth, partly with big firms, partly working under my own shop. Did an MBA in that process at London Business School, which is a great school. But alongside all of that, since 2002, I've been investing in property, been pretty active in that. Back in 2002, it was pretty easy just to buy a flat, rent it out, and the economics worked because it was a favourable market. So very amateur basis. A lot of property ownership and investment ownership of individual flats and houses, etc., is actually amateur.
Which the government is now screwing because they're just killing every tax break left, right and centre. Therefore, the supply of rental property will fall. Therefore, the rents will go up. This is so incompetent.
Exactly. It's the sort of second order effects of taxation, which I argue is not fully understood. And you're right. You're absolutely right. It actually favours larger landlords who can incorporate that and takes away the opportunity for everyday people to sort of have one or two as part of the diversified pension fund.
Can't you incorporate one or two these days?
It doesn't make economic sense.
It doesn't work.
Unfortunately. It's just targeting the wrong place. Don't get me started on that topic. I could last for hours. So over the time, sort of building up sort of more sophisticated strategies in property, I felt that was an area that I could definitely, you know, have an edge because I look at things very analytically and go from investor to a bit more, doing more projects. And you know, that sort of led to bigger picture thinking around traditional finance being broken for property projects. But just before sort of dipping into that, one of the things I have a passion for is what tech can do. I mean, it's not particularly different passion to anyone listening to this podcast, but I got involved quite early on in something called PropTech, so property technology, before probably PropTech as a term was formed.
Which year was this about?
About 6 or 7 years ago. I started investing in startup tech businesses. You know, it's the world's largest asset class. It's got to be more efficient. It's lots of human intervention where maybe it doesn't need that. There are lots of places where it does still need that, which is one of the interesting angles with property and the evolution of PropTech. But yeah, investing in sort of 2025 really interesting prop tech businesses that are really now hitting scale. Real estate as a whole is famously bad at adopting technology. Very, very slow, and that's driven right from the top with big real estate. It is starting to happen now. 2 years ago, McKinsey cited a study saying, sort of likening the adoption of technology by property to basic manufacturing and agriculture. I've definitely used that statement in the wrong room before.
Brilliant. So when did you decide to found Crowd Property, and what was the motivation for that then?
So first and foremost, a few co-founders, there's sort of three core folk co-founders, all of us doing property projects, refurb through to full new build development and saying traditional funding is broken. We've collectively been working in doing that for decades. So across the three of us co-founders, 75 years. So we've been through a lot of pain, a lot of seeing that firsthand, and multiple economic cycles, all of which are important to saying, right, okay, we really know property, and we felt what lacked was a business that does property funding done by property people.
Okay, so if we look at property funding as a whole, how does that break down? What are the subsectors within it? I mean, we mentioned development finance.
Yep.
There's obviously residential mortgages, and I don't know. If you've got a sort of pie chart on the whiteboard over there and you pie slice that up into the bits, what are they?
Well, as an ex-consultant, there are plenty of charts all over.
Absolutely.
All over our business.
Well, keep it simple for some morons like me.
So first and foremost, we fund stuff that has some sort of residential makeup at the end of it. It could be commercial to resi, so it could be a commercial product at the moment. And the elements are broadly short-term finance, which might be bridge, or it might be project finance, or it might be rapid finance.
And short in this context means?
Basically between 12 and 24 months. Probably 6 and 24 months, actually. And then there's term finance, which is basically where it's relatively vanilla. there is clear operating cash flow coming off that asset. Major banks with very low cost of capital, access to cost of capital, you know, they are best players in that commoditized vanilla finance. But we sit at the short-term end where actually deep expertise and really understanding the vision of what is being done is required.
Okay, so that's the more sort of kind of customized end as opposed to wholesale end.
Very much so.
And you say that you guys decided that it was broken. Maybe for the perspective of the audience who don't understand property development, which is perhaps most of them, you can explain how the property development was historically working before you guys came along, what elements you perceived as broken, and then how you sort of fixed them.
Starting horribly big picture and stating somewhat the obvious, we need 300,000 homes being built in this country, in the UK. We build 165,000 of them. That's not new news. What is constraining that? Okay, so there are lots and lots of big, big sites that are being built out by big developers. Okay, that is a well-funded market. The problem is those big sites are being built out. So there are then small sites that need to be developed, and SME developers, SME property professionals, are very, very important to delivering the future needs of housing in the UK. There are two main issues. Number one, planning. Number two, funding. Traditional finance is not structurally set up cost-wise, predominantly, but also responsiveness and service, etc., to serve an SME property professional trying to get a project over the line.
Is that because if I'm an SME property developer, I need small slugs of money sort of in a very variable way, and whoever it is, Megabank PLC, will only give me 100 billion for 5 years fixed or something. I'm caricaturing it.
Very much so. So therefore, you know, end of the queue in terms of, you know, processing of that, etc. So what property professionals, SME property professionals need, okay, is speed, ease and certainty of funding, okay, that enables them to crack on with finding more sites, spending more time on building out those projects, more homes into the economy, more spend in the economy, etc. But that funding side, far more efficient. It's a massive barrier, not only in terms of time, but also in terms of sort of understanding and willingness to play in that traditional funding space.
So in terms of giving us a feel for what mega projects are in property and what the SMEs are looking at, Bridget and I on Saturday went to Petworth. It's a National Trust house, got a vast collection of art in it. So kind of art I find fairly sort of boring, actually, sort of a bit European, you know, fat babies as angels and all that kind of stuff. But there's some brilliant sculptures in there as well. Anyway, mainly because it has a 700-acre deer park, and Saturday was the first day this year since these two other suns come out, so we had to get outside. And driving there, we went down the M23 past Gatwick, and then basically you go west, and it's an awful journey because you go through about, 20 roundabouts or something. It's a complete nightmare around the outskirts of Horsham.
Yep.
And you pass what used to be field after field after field after field after field, full of as many Lego block houses that can be squashed into that field with no community, no resources, no nothing. You know, some developer has bought, 50 acres and 1,000 houses in or something like that. So I assume that is a mega project.
Exactly. They're the large tracts of land that are getting built out by the large developers. The clever stuff really comes to say, right, how can you infill in London? For example, we're funding a project at the moment that's right next to Waterloo Station. Okay, it's a terrace building, there's a complex freehold leasehold structure, okay, and the developer wanted to exploit the air rights on top of that, and they're putting two modular flats on top of it. Okay, that's delivering two more houses, you know, micro level. Yeah, but that is about, you know, part of the densification, part of the ways to improve housing supply into our country.
Okay, so is it gradated into large, medium and small, or is it literally large wholesale, buy 1,000 acres, put 1,000,000 houses down and, you know, add one floor to a building near thing? Or is it a continuum, or is it actually a gap in the middle?
Yeah, it's definitely a continuum, and, you know, as with anything, there's no sort of clear delineation of what an S, what an M and what a, I don't know, L is.
Or what an S&M is for, yeah. That's a different conversation. Right, I see. So anyway, so you're going at the sort of smaller end, the more niche end, where people, as you say, want service and speed and reliability and all that kind of stuff, and where the big players can't service it effectively. And in terms of prop tech, as you say, it's another one of these X-tech things that are floating around. Why did you then decide that actually P2P was a way of doing it? Because P2P, as you've probably noticed yourself, you've got the challenge of managing and balancing the one P with the other P. You've always got too much of this type of P or the other P. You've always got too many potential borrowers but not enough projects, or you've always got too many projects but not enough borrowers. And going back to conversations we had in the podcast many years ago, if banks had to do that, banks would have never got to where banks have got today. The only reason that banks can do that is they created the interbank market. So whichever incoming or outgoing, if you like, whichever they had too much of, they just swapped it around with the banks. And obviously the market as a whole has to be flat. And one of the things that doesn't seem to have happened in P2P is a similar kind of thing, although there was a little bit of it in the past with RateSetter in particular, who got slagged off by Kadeem Schuber of the FT, Alphaville, for being turtles on turtles on turtles, and that you put your money into RateSetter and they put it into some other P2P, and you know, before you know it, as Woody Allen said, a stockbroker is a man who invests your money until it's gone. So in terms of the SME property developer who wants, I don't know, for sake of argument, I don't know, 1.5 million next Tuesday for sort of 7.5 months, that's quite a difficult asset to convert into something that a punter will stick their money into on the other side, isn't it? So isn't P2P a pain, or have you got around it? Because everyone says, oh, P2P, wonderful. Yeah, well, that's sure. At the big picture, that's fine. But actually, at the detailed level, when you're managing it day to day, you're managing basically a treasury function. It's not that easy.
I mean, you're right. You know, we came at this perspective saying, right, we're property experts. Let's talk about property lending that's broken. Okay, then there's a route to market model. We didn't say set up a P2P site and work out, right, okay, what are we pointed at? It's a route to market. And that route to market is a way we chose to build up that lending capacity. And actually, if you look at SME property developers, they're also trying to build a brand as well. And it turns into very much a consumer branding piece, which we think is really, really interesting. Now, what has inevitably happened with our business, as we've proven it over many years, is that institutions have knocked on our door and said, actually, we like what you're giving to the retail. We like your track record. We've been following you, and that builds that sort of complementary lines of capital.
So, in a sense, you've got facilities from institutions in banking terminology.
Exactly, exactly.
So it's not a question. You've got sort of Joe Sixpack putting sort of $10 into it, and you're trying to get all these $10 to make your $1.5 million or whatever you need by next Tuesday.
Exactly, exactly. But you know, if you do it right, and you start with the asset expertise, and you prove a track record, then you've got a wall of capital. You know, and that's very much the situation we're in at the moment.
Yes, I was just thinking, because the last time we touched on this, and I'm sure to property people it's sort of vastly different, but to sort of people a 1,000 kilometres away it looks to be identical. It was with Christian from LendInvest a year or two ago. They are technically not a P2P anymore as far as the FCA is concerned.
Yep.
This one used to be on the P2P FA. I don't know whether they're on it anymore. So this P2P thing itself became to have a technical meaning. And as I recall, Christian was doing retail bonds at the time to get over this thing that when you've got a variable demand, then having some certainty around supply is really helpful. I mean, another example is Augmentum Fintech, who are on the show recently, where they're a listed fintech VC fund. I saw they're trying to raise another $150 million recently. So one of the things in terms of how P2P has moved on from 5 years was precisely what I say, which is that in a treasury function in a bank, the only way you can manage the fact that incoming and outgoing are never the same on any day is because all banks get together and they do swapsies. And I think that P2P never addressed that. It never had a sort of an intra P2P market moving stuff around. But it seems to move in this direction of becoming a conduit for institutional, in the broadest sense, funds, whether it's a listed bond, as with LendInvest, or Augmentum Fintech, or you basically having lines from institutions.
Exactly. So firstly, property professionals want speed and certainty. That's what we've built our business on. Certainty is delivered if you have complementary sources of capital, number one, and number two, they do act in a truly complementary way. Now, peer-to-peer, generally, people have managed that individually on platforms at the moment. It's an interesting thought whether that goes into some kind of intra-platform approach. But ultimately, you know, delivering that certainty ensures you get high-quality property professionals applying to your platform as a true alternative to the bank. And we position ourselves as a lender of first resort. So we are taking out the bank in that respect. But then there are other efficiencies on top of that.
Yes. So the line I'm thinking about the P2P is the sort of, is P2P disappearing? Or I mean, it certainly changed from the original idea. And the reason I say, is it disappearing? Is because I'm thinking back to an episode, the name entirely escapes me, last year on supply chain finance. So they would not call themselves a P2P whatsoever. And you do, but what's in a label? But if they were here, they're basically doing the same thing, which is they're taking some difficult asset class, as far as an institutional investor is concerned, and they're packaging it up in a way
Yeah.
They're wrapping it up in a nice box and say, oh, look, it's a rectangular box of this size. You know, it's like containers. Containers are used to move physical goods around the world all the time. The container's been a great invention because it's all the same size. So you could container ships and you've got lorries and that's good. So they were doing the same thing for the supply chain finance, which is a real mess because it's been going around for thousands of years and they were boxing it all up. So to a certain extent, another way of viewing what you're doing without emphasising sort of the kind of fintechy word is that, is it true to say that you're taking a difficult to invest in asset class and you're making it more investable for institutional investors?
Very much so. But first and foremost, how we're trying to deliver on that is from the basis of the pure ethos of P2P. So more efficient matching supply and demand of capital, all of that you covered many times. And if we deliver that in the best way, leveraging all of the data analytics and expertise requirements within property, doing a damn good job, okay, what you're able to do is you're able to say, right, we've built an efficient model, number one. Okay, the peer, the retail lender is important to that. Okay, if we deliver a great model there, institutions come and knock on the door. That then means the surety of capital across multiple sources. Therefore, property professionals come to us and there are more projects for both institutions and the peer. And that virtuous circle is what we're driving right now.
Yes, so looking at the asset side of the equation, as you say, a lot of analysis goes into that, and like all markets, traditionally brokers have played an important part in this world. So as somebody who isn't a property development expert, or as somebody who isn't even a property development amateur, what is the role that brokers play, and how do you relate to brokers, or how do you disintermediate them, or don't you disintermediate them?
So 95% plus of the property finance market is brokered. And there's value in that, and from our perspective, we actually wanted to take that out for multiple reasons. So first and foremost, economically, there's 1 to 2 percentage points on that loan that the broker will take off us as lender. They'll also typically take 1% off the borrowers as well. So therefore, you've got immediate inefficiency of 2 to 3%. Nobody really has cracked this at scale to drive a property developer brand. We had various sort of unique factors about our founding team and makeup that enabled us to say, at least give it a go at cracking that problem of building direct applications from property developers and grassroots SME property developers. But actually, where I think it comes in far more powerfully than pure efficiency is in the direct relationships that we have with all of those property developers. So we are talking to them directly, you know, on a daily, every other day, weekly basis. Okay, our experts talking to them about their vision. What we're doing there is we're building a strong relationship, but we are understanding the qualitative, the human factors, the behavioural factors, the psychological factors of, are they going to deliver on that property project? That gives us far richer underwriting that when you put with all of our data analytics, it's an incredibly powerful system.
Yes, I saw something in passing last week, but it was so in passing I don't even remember it. But it was somewhere in America. It was a prop tech. I don't think it was a fintech at all, but it was a prop tech company, and they use a hell of a lot of automation, and they can derive prices of properties and da-da-da-da-da-da and rental values and 360-degree tours and mumble. Anyway, it's probably quite a well-known one, but the name escapes me. And again, an argument's been going around for a long time, which is how much can you use computers and how much you need people. The original reason I clicked on the thing was that I'm sceptical about how much you can use computers in some circumstances. But it was clearly, I don't know, American suburbs where every house is identical.
Exactly.
You know, and in those circumstances, it's super easy to have a computer and sort of, you know, oh, it's got 5,000 square metres, not 4,500 square metres, and the yard is this big and that big.
You can have the Parker's Guide for secondhand cars for that.
Exactly. Whereas London's a prime example, it's all very, very different. And so you need the human input. And of course, there's a trade-off between the two. So you're speaking to the market directly and saving the value chain in terms of the percentages that are not going through the broker.
Yeah.
How many deals are you doing at the moment per annum, or what sort of kind of volumes have you done in total? Going back to what S&M might mean in SME.
So we've taken some time to grow because we've been cracking that difficult problem. We think it gives fundamental strategic advantage for the long term. We've funded 40 million to date, £100 million worth of end product.
And how many deals is that?
97 projects, I think it is. Where we have the really, really strong lead indicator is that we're seeing the benefits of all of that hard work on the direct origination side. So our run rate not based on the last 3 minutes, but based on the last sort of 4 or 5 months, we're seeing £1.7 billion worth of applications for funding direct into our platform.
And what that means is it gives us a material proportion of the market to make the highest quality lending decisions, to select the ones that we will lend against. And we will be able to win that business because of exceptional speed of service and depth of relationship.
Yes, I'm just musing, when you say that, I'm just musing that, you know, in terms of that sort of kind of arithmetic, and what is a topic we talked to Jeff Lynn about a few weeks ago on the equity side, equity crowdfunding, which is the premise when people started is that people will want to pick their own individual assets. Some people will. Plenty of people like me just ain't got the bloody time. I haven't got the time to go through seeders and read all the stuff and try and understand it and all that kind of thing. So, you know, they're setting up one way and another a fund which will invest in, I don't know, the top 100 ones or something like that, which will, and an auto diversification button. Anyway, people are interested can listen to that precise show on the mechanisms. But it's the same thing, which is that one of the things that sort of changed is everybody's realised that they're even busier than before. So I wonder whether, you know, if we're talking in 5 years' time, you'll have a retail listed bond or you'll have a fund where the likes of me can invest, because you're clearly putting a lot of work into creating all these assets, and individual assets are all fine, but a punter like me, A, does not have the ability to second guess you. You've done all these assets and you put them there at a price and all that kind of stuff, or however it works. I'm not going to add any value. And B, I shouldn't be bunging all my money in one of your things anyway. I want exposure to the lot. So maybe all this stuff is P2Ps. Maybe it all eventually just disappear into funds of one sort or another. I don't want to spoil the P2P FA's day, because I know you're off to a P2P FA board meeting fairly soon. But you can tell the Mike thinks they've got no future. It's all over.
Yeah, exactly. The very important thing here the very interesting thing, certainly about British culture, is it's a property nation. We fund things that have at least part of a residential end product. People have a view on location type, architecture, condition, proposition, micro and macro location, I should say. And it's kind of a favourite dinner party conversation. So what we see on our platform is that people are selecting, and also they are using our auto-diversification product. So both of those work, and both of them gain engagement with our business in different ways.
Good. Okay, well, that's interesting to see how that's going. So in terms of the sort of ping pong, maybe the answer somewhere in the middle, which is that there still is P2P in the sense that P2P was intended in the first place. But there's also quite a trend towards P2P kind of just dissolving itself and become packaging assets into a fund. And no doubt we will see as time goes on. So before we wrap up the show, I'd like to thank all the listeners out there and my brand partners for the podcast, Smart Pension, who are far, secure and free. Check out their UK workplace pensions at autoenrollment.co.uk. So, Mike, would you like to tell us a little bit more about Crowd Property in detail? You know, we've mentioned the name once or twice, and a little bit about what you do, but not particularly dived into the topic. And you, just to pick up on the last thing you were saying that it's a property nation. I think certainly, historically, it was. And I mentioned Thatcher, who's subject of, actually, a very good BBC documentary. It's very good, and BBC don't tend to go in the same sentence these days, but it's old-school BBC, without actually just going over the history of the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. And one of the things that was sort of very big those days was making it a property nation. But, of course, as anybody with kids knows these days, or anyone with kids in London knows, that's becoming a rather historic concept, unless mummy and daddy are particularly well off. Good luck buying a property in London if you're a nurse or a teacher.
Indeed, indeed. The undersupply nature of the British property market. So, as I said earlier, it's 1.7 billion application rate, fund 5 to 10% of that.
Having mentioned Cedars before, is a similar rejection rate to them, which is about 90-95% rejection.
You know, as a lender, it's very easy to give people money. You're only a lender if you get it back again, otherwise you're a charity without a cause. So, you know, we're building that business for the absolute long term based on really fundamentally understanding the pains of SME developers. And that has knock-on effects to delivering housing supply and spend in the UK economy. That's really important. But it's that fundamental pain, that expertise, that we're doing this damn well and building a 10, 20, 30 plus year business around it. And just to finalise on that institution P2P point, okay, if my mother lends on our platform, okay, she's done 42 years of due diligence on me, arguably, but an equivalent lender cannot spend that time doing due diligence, whereas institutions coming in is good for the sector because they're putting that rigor all over it, you know, crawling all over these businesses to make sure that they are building differentiated lending models. That's what we're doing at Crowd Property. We're pushing hard to deliver, and that's why our growth trajectory is going to continue, if not drive at a higher growth rate now, given we've cracked this broker disintermediation point.
And we're sitting here in London today, but one of the points that hasn't emerged so far is that you're one of this very rare category of regional fintech, because you're actually, as you mentioned, you mentioned in passing earlier, you were at university opposite where I was at school. But you're based in Birmingham as a business.
Indeed, which for us is great. And that's part of the legacy of the business. You know, our fixed cost base is under half what it would be in London. We are a standout fintech, proptech business in Birmingham. And our ability to attract great talent is incredible. And so we're very, very proud in that. We lend nationally, but we're a very proud West Midlands business.
Yes, and like Blue Motor Finance, former brand partners of this podcast, they're based in Sevenoaks, which isn't as cheap as Birmingham, but it is rather bizarre, and maybe it's the start of a little bit of a trend, but rather bizarre that in this world of tech and laptops on beaches, as the theory went 20 years ago or whatever, that more and more people try and crowd into this tiny central London thing, which is quite mad. And I was watching one of these very good history things on YouTube. One of these, I've forgotten who it was by now, I don't know, Emperor Tiger Star or something like that, which is they colour maps, and every year you get, like every year from 500 AD or something, yeah, the history of the British Isles. And you see the colours, the sort of Danes come and the Normans come and all this kind of stuff. And actually reading Robert Toombs' excellent book, 1,000 pages, I'm ready, yeah, the first page and a half, on the history of the English people, he makes the point that the Normans, from whom we should be seeking reparations, of course, for being our sort of colonial invaders for a few centuries, they did two things. Firstly, after the Normans invaded in 1066, they actually shored up our defences a hell of a lot, because so nobody really invaded ever again. The Spanish Armada got beaten up by the winds and all that kind of stuff, and Hitler never quite made it here. So the Normans did that for us. But the other thing that the Normans introduced was massive centralisation. So what you saw, you know, 500 years before was hell of a lot of regions, Mercia and Northumbria, and all of these were, you know, different countries in modern language. And this centralisation has been a force that's been going on for 1,000 years, but it's about time it started to be reversed. And as we're in an economic world these days, the idea that you can half your cost base just by going an hour and 26 minutes on the train,
exactly,
is mental, given that a number of fintechs that I know, and I'm sure you know, do near offshoring in Belarus or Ukraine, which is very good, but it comes with its own sets of challenges.
Yes.
Which, I mean, you know, okay, there's a slightly foreign language in Birmingham, but, you know, maybe you're bilingual. And yeah, it's crazy that you can go 100 miles in this country and half your cost base, but more people don't. So why don't they go there?
Firstly, there's nothing that would pay me more in this world than to have a W1 address and the costs associated with it. Secondly, the fact that we are in Birmingham and can attract great talent and manage that fixed cost base means that we can have everything in-house. And that creates absolute control within your business. Okay, and that's powerful. My tech team are within 5 paces of my desk, which sort of makes them a little bit nervous. But that's really important to be able to give structured speed of delivery on our innovation.
Yes, we had Orcron a little while ago, and they're based in Belfast. The cost base might be even sort of cheaper up there. So anyway, a big flag wave for all the regional fintechs out there. It is crazy in terms of everyone trying to squeeze themselves into central London one way or another, and there's vast talent pool around the country. And also what you're doing is relocating some of the employment to the regions where it is more needed. So I wish you every success in the future, and maybe we'll see in a few years whether P2P still is a capital P2P, or P2P is something that you look up in an encyclopedia of historic terms, and whether it's all turned into funds. But certainly, for a whole variety of reasons, as you imply, the UK property market really needs a lot of development, and I wish you every success in the future.
Thank you, Mike. Much appreciated.
Thanks for listening. If you have consulting, advisory/non-exec, or media needs in the FS or fintech space, get in touch with me at mike@londonfintechpodcast.com.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. To come away from the city, the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so grey, with the pain of the everyday. the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight dance.